Session number 802, Bill Alexander, Reel 1.
Well, what about, you know, the early life in the 30s?
Right. My father was a carpenter who brought 7 children into the world and died. And then my mother, who was a very fine woman, had the problem of bringing us up. And her attitude was that so long as we could win scholarships and get an education, she was prepared to live in very frugal circumstances. And so most of the family, in one way or another, got a higher education, and I won scholarships and got a degree in chemistry at Reading University. I had difficulty in getting a job. This was in 1931, but I finally got a job as, first of all, an assistant and then a works chemist in a paper mill. And it was my mother's influence and the problems of the family that made me interested in politics, and I joined the Communist Party in 1932, and then when the war began in Spain, there was no question about where my sympathies lay and why I felt I had to take a part. There was another point too. I'd reached a stage in my career as a works chemist where I either went on to the management side, which I wouldn't have liked, or I did something else. And so I finally decided to go to Spain in the spring of 37.
Just before we get on to that, the party had sent round, if I understand it, appeals, had it not, for volunteers. Polly toured the country and sent letters and all this sort of thing. How were you actually approached?
Well, it was true. There was the news in the Daily Worker. I read and met a number of people. I'd attended public meetings at which there'd been speakers, but nobody approached me and said, "Would you go?" I myself said I'd like to go, and because I was reasonably well known in my local branch of the Communist Party in Southeast London, when I went to, I knew where to go, 1 Litchfield Street, and there were no problems and no difficulties.
You weren't married at that time?
No, I was single at the time. Yes.
How did your family react?
Well, I remember this very well because I went down to see my mother, who was still living in the New Forest, and it was a beautiful spring evening, and I remember the scent of the trees, in particular the sweet briar in her garden, and she was both proud and at the same time sorry that I was going. And so this sort of memory and my mother's kiss of the smell of sweet briar I took with me for quite some time. Well, I got to Spain.
And this was in the spring of
37. Yes.
So this will be after Jarama, in fact.
Well, after the main battles of Jarama, yes.
How did you get across, by the way?
Oh, we went across what was then the standard route from Paris down through France, and then by bus to the foothills of the Pyrenees, and then walking over. I remember a couple of incidents worth reading. I was young, and I've always been fairly fit, and it was a fairly strenuous climb, but I always remember some of the less fit and less vigorous people having to be left on the roadside. We got to the top just as dawn was breaking, and we saw the whitewashed rocks which marked the border, and we managed to raise a cheer and a short run to get over into Spain, and then we made our way downhill towards a farmhouse, thinking of breakfast and something to eat. And there we were given a cup of a brown liquid, which I was to believe was ground up acorns, and a small square of bread. And then began what for nearly everyone was a period of hunger until we finally left Spain. Not starvation, but hunger compared to what we'd been used to in Britain.
From the farmhouse, where did you go to then?
We went to Figueres. We were there a couple of days.
Presumably there'd be a small party of you, wouldn't there?
Yes. There was a party of changing composition. In other words, some people got left here and got left there on the way. Maybe I should tell, although you've probably got a lot of this, I remember we were in Sète, which is in the south of France, and there was a hold-up further along the Underground Railway, if you like, and there were about 100 of us, Americans, some British, various nationalities, crowded into a small room, and we were only allowed out to visit the local latrine, which was in the open air. And this had a half door with a wonderful view over the harbour, where the men were fishing with the nets they dropped into the channel and then pulled them up in the hope. So you went there as often as you could and sat there as long as you could, sort of enjoying the change of scenery. Again, the very rather silly and trivial things that remain in your memory.
Well, so you're in Figueres. The
yes, in Figueres, we then on a train through Barcelona to Albacete to the British base, which was in the village of Madrigueras.
Yeah. Who was in command then of the battalion?
Well, we were not yet with the battalion. This was just sort of a holding area, because the battalion was or had already been in action at Jarama. So while I was there, some anti-tank guns had arrived, and it was decided to form a British anti-tank battery. There were Malcolm Dunbar was the commander, and Hugh Slater was the political commissar. We had three guns and about 24 men, of whom roughly half were British and half were Spanish. We had a certain amount of training firing these guns in the nearby hills, and then we went by train and lorry to the Jarama front. We took up positions there, roughly about 100 yards or so behind the trenches in which the British battalion were.
Copeman was in the trenches. Fred Copeman was there, wasn't he, at that time?
Fred Copeman was with the battalion, but we were not part of the battalion, we were part of the 15th Brigade.
Yeah. He spoke very highly of these young university people on this weaponry, and said you were very precise and you always aimed very correctly and always got your target. Was that right? Were you the group he was referring to? I presume you were.
Yes, this is the group. The anti-tank guns were actually Soviet, and they were, at that time, the advanced weapon in the world. I know this because the American military attaché visited us at one time, purely socially, but studied extremely carefully these weapons. And afterwards, when I joined the British Army, I realized that these guns in 37 were certainly in advance of anything that the British Army had at that time, or indeed until about 19, till after the first years of the war. They fired two types of shell. One was an armored piercing shell, which were to be used against tanks or a fortified gun emplacement, and the other was a high explosive shell. They had an extremely high velocity, so that it was almost possible to aim directly at your target, because the trajectory, that is the height that the shell rose, was very limited indeed. And therefore, after a little bit of practice, we did become quite capable at hitting what we wanted. On the Harama, we spotted machine gun posts on the other side, and then creeping up either at dusk or early dawn, just poking so that we could see them, but they could very rarely see us. And indeed, at the extreme range for a rifle bullet, we fire a couple or three rounds, which was an effective way of destroying the fascist machine gun posts.
What date were you there? Did you actually go into action on the front? Can you remember?
No, I'm afraid I'm very poor on dates.
This would be sometime when, around March, would it be?
No, it would have been later. The battalion was still in the line, and we were up there for... they were there a total of 60 days, and we were there probably for 3 weeks to a month before we were all withdrawn.
I see. Yeah. Were you there after this incident when the trench was captured by the Moors?
That was we were there afterwards.
You came after that.
Yeah.
Are there any particular details about that front that stand out in your mind as opposed to other fronts?
Yes. What both surprised me was the character of the trench warfare that had developed there, and the comparative inactivity. This was a period of almost stalemate on the front, when no one knew, when the fascists were not trying to make a breakthrough there, and the Republican forces didn't have the reserves to attempt a breakthrough. And in fact, because of the fairly effective trench system that had been developed, any attack from either side would have been a very costly business. And in fact, the Harama front stayed static until the very last days of the war, and then it broke, not by an attack, but because the whole front disintegrated.
You'd be a fairly young man there, in your sort of early 20s, mid-20s.
Yes, I was 27 at the
27.
Time.
Presumably you'd heard a lot about the First World War, the fighting there as a young man. You'd read about it, wouldn't you?
Yes, I'd read about it, yes.
The Somme and so on. What was your first reaction on going into trench-type warfare?
Well, as I said, we actually were not in the trenches. We were about 100 yards behind, that is, on the convex slope, where life was comparatively easy. We had dugouts to deal with shells, but with the exception of stray bullets, we were safe until we moved our guns up a few yards in order to see over the brow of the hill and do our firing. Then we withdrew to the comparative safety.
And what was your first reaction going under fire?
I just, at that stage, my first reaction I cannot remember. But later on, when the Battle of Brunetti began to develop, and I, for the first few days, was attached as a runner to the brigade, I had to run down a hill to the Dimitrovs, and I was under fire, but I have a certain air of detachment. I don't feel it's me that's running or being fired at. I'm almost remote.
When you were on the anti-tank gun battery, who was the commander of the battalion then?
Of the battalion. That was, at that time, was Fred Copeman.
It was Copeman at that
time.
Can you remember his second in command?
No, because we had very little contact with them.
And do you remember things like battalion commissar?
No, because again, we were a separate unit, you see, coming under the 15th Brigade, and so that we had very little contact.
And you said your own commissar was Hugh Slater.
Hugh Slater, right? Yes.
What sort of man was he?
Hugh Slater was a very capable man, rather dilettante in his interest, but an intelligent political man.
And how did he carry out his function of commissar? I mean, can you remember the outstanding things you can remember about what a commissar did to earn his bread, as it were?
Well, Hugh, his real name was Humphrey, had a very easy job as commissar, in the sense that we were all very keen people, and with a number of other sort of outstanding individual members. There was Miles Tomalin, who was a writer and a poet, played the recorder. There were Jeff Mildwater, who was a very capable soldier. So, in a way, in our unit, the political commissar, which was a small one, the political commissar had comparatively little to do. Malcolm Dunbar, who afterwards became the Chief of Staff of the 15th Brigade, was also a very capable, intelligent man, and the whole of this battery worked extremely well as a unit, with every man sort of being keen to master the guns and behave in, well, an exemplary way. Mm-hmm. So after we left Harama, we went into the Battle of Brunetti. At Villanueva, we played no part at all. I think we may have fired a few rounds, but we didn't play a major part.
That's Villanueva de la Canada.
De la Canada, yes. Then, in the fighting for Brunetti, we used the anti-tank guns to shell the church, and again, that had quite a devastating effect.
At this point you'd be incorporated into the battalion, wouldn't you?
No, we were never incorporated into the battalion.
No, we
were always separate, and our orders came directly from the brigade. We were a brigade unit. I personally went into the battalion at a later stage.
Who sent you your orders? Can you remember?
The orders came from the 15th Brigade. Chopich was already in command. Cunningham was in command of two of the battalions of the 15th Brigade, and George Aitken was the brigade political commissar.
He was over the three battalions.
No, of the whole four battalions in the 15th Brigade.
Which was the fourth battalion? How many battalions were there altogether?
Right, well, it changed. Yeah. But at the start of Brunetti, there was the British battalion, the Dimitrovs, who were afterwards left. There were two American battalions. Yeah. The Lincoln and the Washington were separate. But they were bombed heavily, and they were combined into the Lincoln Washington. And then there was a Spanish battalion.
Was there also the Franco-Belge battalion?
No, they had left the 15th Brigade at the end of Jarama.
Ah, okay. Yeah. One piece of history sorted out. Okay. And so it was Chopic who was the brigade commander, in fact.
Yes.
And Aitken, who was the brigade commissar.
Commissar.
And you say Cunningham, did you say?
Yes.
Was in charge of two battalions.
Yes, two battalions. Yeah.
The British and which other one?
Well, I can't check, but I'm pretty certain it was the American.
The Americans. And
that was the Lincoln. Well. At the actual start, there were two separate battalions of Americans, the Lincoln Battalion and the Washington Battalion. But when we bypassed Brunetti, they were advancing over open fields in rather close formation, and they were both heavily bombed and with very heavy casualties. And so within a matter of days, they were, in fact, probably hours, the remnants of the two battalions formed the Lincoln Washington, which remained as such for the remainder of the war.
Did you see that bombing? They were struck by Italian planes.
Yes, I saw it.
You saw it. Weren't they, from what we've heard, they were advancing to join up with the British battalion, which were on the side of a hill further on.
Yes, they were advancing down open ground towards the river, on the other side of which were the hills, which were sort of overlooking Madrid. And they were caught in the open by this flight of bombers. They were quite high up. It was a matter of luck or accurate bombing, and at that stage it was luck came into it, but they were caught.
Were they in fact Italian bombers?
Well, I wouldn't like to say whether they were Italian or whether they were German.
Someone said that they thought they knew what they were.
Well, people express all sorts of views. I was not, at that time, sufficiently familiar with the difference between a Junker and a Caproni to tell the difference.
Yeah.
And also, probably, I was so interested myself in finding a quiet corner, I didn't spend too much time looking up.
Okay, is there anything else about the thing that you remember about Brunetti?
Yes, I remember this. We then took our guns across the river and were in positions again behind the infantry. And there was one occasion when our ammunition dump, which we always kept a few yards away, all the grass caught fire, but we managed to put it out. Malcolm Dunbar was wounded. Slater was made battery commander, and I was promoted political commissar. The big fascist counterattack began, and they were coming over in, well, platoon strength, groups of about 30 men, and in fact, very badly led. We had our guns along a ridge, and when we could get one explosive shell in the middle of a group, we brought about a number of casualties, but also stopped that group advancing. And it was in one counterattack by the fascists when I was standing slightly in front of the gun in the excitement, and because of the very high velocity shell, I became completely stone deaf for about 3 days. And I still, it still destroyed the hearing in my, it shattered the nerve endings in my left ear.
They were so loud, the guns, were they? They were so loud.
Yeah, well, it's, the higher the velocity of your shell, the higher the frequency of the sound it makes. You know, it's not a boom, it's a crack. And your nerve ending, or at least my nerve endings, are more sensitive to high frequency. If you were behind the gun shield, then you were quite safe.
How were these guns hauled? Did you have tractors with them, or special vehicles?
No, the guns along the road, they were hauled. They were tied on the back of a lorry, and with the crew and the gun crew and the ammunition in the lorry. When you had to leave the lorry behind, they were pulled by men. There were two ropes attached to the wheels, and there was a very long I've forgotten the technical word for it, not being an artilleryman. Anyway, there were two arms which also provided, were afterwards spread apart to provide the stable base against which the gun recoil took place. Pulling these guns up and down the hills certainly required, well, considerable hard work. The wheels were made of rubber tires, and the whole gun was really comparatively light. Although the barrel was long, the caliber was only 35 millimeters. That is just over 2 inches.
The Nationalists started their counter-offensive from about the middle of the month, is that right?
Yes.
You had about a week or so of fighting.
Yes.
And then they had a big counterattack.
Yes.
And for the first few days you held them off, I understand.
Yes.
And then what happened after that?
Well, may I just sort of interject? We were then on the hills, beyond the river. The river had almost dried up, and there was the sun was very intense, and we were dehydrated. But running down the hillside towards the river were little gullies, still with a slight trace of green. So we dug holes in the sand, and after a short time, a little sort of muddy liquid would accumulate in the bottom, and this was scooped up and drank. And it was there that dysentery really began to affect, certainly affected the whole of the battery, probably from this water we were drinking. We were also subject to quite frequent bombing attacks. At that stage it was all high-level bombing, no strafing, because we still had anti-aircraft guns, a few of our own planes, and so it was all high-level bombing.